Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Brian Carr, 20 years of career experience, fire chief with the City of Stockton Fire Department in California. Brian was actually in the legal field and didn't have aspirations of becoming a firefighter, but felt like he wanted to do more with his life. His sister was a paramedic and mentioned the fire service. And with that notion, Brian became more curious and began to look into what exactly he needed to get his foot in the door. Once he stepped inside, he fell in love with the service and being able to give back to the community. Brian's mindset and how he views the fire service should be the reason anyone in this profession strives to become fire chief. The fire service has these type of chiefs around the country, but we need more of them. Fire chiefs who actually care about their employees, their well-being, training, education, performance, and overall remembering what it's like to be a tailboard fireman. Yet humble enough to remember the organization isn't just about them and allowing firefighters to be just that. Firefighters. Plain and simple. With that, I present Brian Carr.
Good morning. My name is Brian Carr. I'm fire chief for the City of Stockton here in California. I've been in the fire service for 20 years. Started as kind of an older young man. I was had another career. I had actually been in the legal field. Decided that I wasn't necessarily feeling as fulfilled as I thought I wanted to be or could be. My sister was a paramedic in Northern California here, and she asked me about the fire service. If I'd ever thought about a career in the fire service. And I'd always thought about public service. I'd thought about being out on the streets, helping people. So it seemed like a natural fit. And I kind of started down that road of looking into my EMT, doing some ride-alongs. And as I got to know more about the career, I just fell in love with it. Fell in love with the opportunity, being out there helping people, the challenge every day being a different challenge, something new. So I started testing and making a shift in my career path. I was newly married. I had one small child, but my wife was a great partner and was willing to wanted me to be happy and enjoy what I was doing. So I started pursuing the fire service, and I got hired here actually in Stockton in September of 2005, and ended up just working my way. It was about 9 years as a firefighter, promoted to fire captain, battalion chief, division chief, deputy, and then most recently here this last year was appointed fire chief, the 17th fire chief here in the City of Stockton. So it's been a great career, and I'm just enjoying the ride right now and some new challenges. So that's kind of the nutshell of how I got to where I'm at.
Okay. And my first question for you is, you said you started in 2005. Has Stockton always been the way it is as far as fires and culture and aggressiveness?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From day one, we've kind of instilled that in the recruits in the academy, that we're going to take an aggressive approach to saving life, property, and the environment. So any call that we're on, we're always looking to see, you know, kind of make the assumption of how do we save this life? How do we save this building? How do we save more property? So that aggressive nature is just kind of embedded in us in the academy, that we are an interior firefighting organization. We will take calculated risks when it's necessary. You know, when we get a primary complete and secondary, and we know there's no life threatened, you know, that will definitely gauge back what we do on the fire ground. But we're still going to, you know, if we can confine to room of origin, if we can confine to the building of origin, that's still our aggressive nature. So,
okay. So you got hired with Stockton, you went through the academy. Upon completion, what was your first assignment?
So my first, this is, I'm actually kind of embarrassed to say this, but I was all set to go out of the academy to engine four, which was one of our busiest engines in the mid, kind of the upper north side of Stockton. I had gone out, met the crew, got my feet wet, you know, as far as the station. And about 2 days before I was ready to start, I got a call telling me that I was actually going to be going to engine 13. There was a last minute personnel move that had to happen. And engine 13 opened as a fire station in like 2003 or 2004. So it was a brand new firehouse. In fact, we were in a two-story single family house that had been added a carport, basically a bay onto the side of it for the engine. We were working as I came out of the academy. We just went from 24 48s to the 48 96. And in 48 hours, we would run to 2 to 5 calls in the 48 hours. And I was right out of the academy. I was green. I had no fire service experience. I was an EMT with limited EMT experience. So the kind of the comical part I'll share, and I hope it doesn't come across bad, but I was literally going around the firehouse taking blood pressures, doing EMT assessments of my crew at Station 13. But needless to say, it was a short assignment. It was 2 or 3 months. And then from there, I'm trying to think where I went. I want to say I was from there was to a truck tour, one of our trucks, our downtown trucks. So I definitely, after Engine 13, it definitely ramped up. I got some good sets and reps after that, but it was not the place you look to start when you're coming out of the academy.
And so once you transition to the next station, even the station you're at, even at 13, did you seek out or did you kind of gravitate to individuals you wanted to emulate? You wanted to be that into the job firefighter?
Yeah, so as much as I laugh about my Engine 13 experience, that experience is what actually formed the basis of my career, because the captain I was working for had a long history in our water rescue program, which wasn't at Station 13, it was at Station 6. But he had a long history in our water rescue program. His driver had a long history in the water rescue program. And at the time, we had the 4-0 staffing on the engine. So the senior firefighter was an open spot on Engine 13, but it was filled by, on overtime a lot by other people that were part of the water rescue program. So I actually got my first exposure to those captains, those engineers, those firefighters that were part of that program. And ultimately, when I got off probation, it was those people that recruited me to come to the water rescue station and be a part of the water rescue team. So it was actually a foundation of my career.
And how important would you say it is for others that are either not green into the fire service or coming into the fire service to find that mentor, whether that individual knows it or not?
Oh, I think it's paramount. And the thing I would say is, you don't just have to have that one mentor. You know, you can have multiple mentors. None of us, even myself now, as I try to mentor other people, it's like I want them to have other mentors, other perspectives, other, you know, people they feel like they can emulate, they can ask for advice. So yeah, I highly recommend that you look for those mentors, and you don't even have to have that awkward conversation about, will you be my mentor? You know, just having the relationship where you know you can go to them, you can emulate what they're doing, you can ask them questions, and you know it's somebody that's going to give you good advice and help you through your career. So yeah, I think it's very important.
And so at what point in your career did you decide, it's a two-part question. At what point in your career did you decide to start moving up the ranks and why?
So, I was a firefighter for 9 years. I actually promoted to captain in 2014. I took the captain's test right after. So, the city of Stockton filed bankruptcy in 2011. The biggest part of that, what happened for the fire department, is aside from drastic cuts in pay and benefits for the employees, they also took four people off the engine and they dropped that to three. And they took five off our trucks and dropped that to four person staffing. So what happened, I was had been at our water rescue house, and then when the bankruptcy came, I was the fourth firefighter, so I got moved out of that station for a little while. But so some of that was a catalyst, and we hadn't done any promoting from probably we hadn't run any promotional test, I want to say from like 2010 to maybe 2012, maybe even a little bit earlier, 2009 to 2012. So there was a window there where there was no promotional opportunities for years, couple years. So I continued to perfect my craft, try to be a good firefighter. I had great crews. I swapped crews at the water rescue house, got to learn from a different crew, picked up different things from everybody. But at some point when the bankruptcy came about, and then they did the first promotional exam we had done in years. The first one they offered was the captain's exam. And our requirements were basically 5 years on the job to be eligible for the captain's exam. So I was eligible, and I decided at the same time, I was actually on our executive board for the union, and I was heavily involved in negotiations and trying to keep us above water after we filed bankruptcy. So I was super busy, and I was like, I don't really have time to study. But I decided I would just put my name in, go for the exam, study, do what I could do. And we actually had, I want to say 80, I mean, we had a department at that time after the bankruptcy. We had a department of, we were probably 180 to 200 members. We had 80 people sign up for the written test for the captains. That's how long there had been with no promotional exams. So needless to say, there was twofold. My reason for promoting or seeking the promotion was I felt like I was ready. We hadn't had any promotional exams in a long time, and I wanted to take an exam at least to get the experience, if nothing else. So.
Okay. And listening to how you described it, you are allowed to skip rank in Stockton.
You are allowed to skip rank.
Okay.
I would say this, going back, if I had anything to do over again, I wouldn't skip rank. I would love to have driven. I would love to have been an engineer. I would love to have been in that role. At the time, the first promotional exam that came out was the captain's exam. Like I said, I was buried with executive board negotiations and work for the union. So I barely made it through that exam. And I would say 3 to 6 months later, while I was waiting for test results from the captain's exam, they put out an engineer's exam. And I
Gotcha.
was just like, I just don't have the bandwidth right now. So I left it where it was at. I got on the captain's, I passed the exam. I left it. I got on the captain's list, eligibility list. I was high enough where I knew I'd be promoted. And so I left it there. But obviously, going back in time, hearing people talk about the engineer rank and me knowing what I know today, I would love to have been part of that rank. Yeah.
Okay. And if you don't mind, can you just briefly explain how Stockton does their captain's process? Of course, you take a written test, and then upon completion, what are the next steps?
So we have a written test. I'm trying to remember. I get them confused depending on rank, but I think our rules of civil service, which I'm not a fan of, and we've got to look at making a modification. But the written exam is weighted like 60 or 70% of the total exam, which I think is completely backwards. So then what we do after you pass, you need like a passing score of 70. You go to what we call the oral assessment exam. And we usually always bring in an independent third party vendor to run the assessment center. And that assessment center will consist of role plays, with personnel problems. It'll consist of captain expectations and questions from a panel, outside panel. It'll consist of an emergency or multiple emergency scenarios that you'll have to navigate. And it's usually at least a day-long process for each candidate. And then that's the end of the testing process. You'll get scored on both your written and your oral assessment. Like I said, I think it's 70-30 right now. And then that score will go to civil service. You don't find out until civil service gets it, and then they certify the list and you're ranked. There are seniority points. I take that back. There are seniority points that get factored in as well. So if you're a more senior individual in the department, you get certain amount of seniority points per year in the department. So
And only answer this if you want to. I don't want to put you in a hot seat or anything, but if you mentioned if you could change it, I just kind of want to know why would you change it where like you stated the written exam holds a lot of weight compared to the rest of the exam.
Well, and I don't know. I as somebody who's got a graduate degree, I put a lot of value in education. I put a ton of value in education. I put a ton of value in being able to write, and present yourself either verbally or orally, communicate well. But our written exam kind of became like, do you have enough time in your day to study and read the books and do the outlines versus, are you somebody like myself who was involved in contract negotiations for the city and the union? Somebody at a busy, busy firehouse, maybe doesn't have the time and opportunity to put into as much written material. And when I look at what we're trying to capture, we definitely need our captains. We need our company officers to be able to communicate orally and verbally. But I also think we can do that training that, once you get into the position, I can help you if that's a weakness of yours. But really, what are my company officers? My company officers are daily leaders in the firehouse. They need to know how to resolve personnel problems. They need to have experience in personnel issues, conflict resolution. They're the first on scene of almost every emergency that we go to. They need to know how to be able to handle emergencies. So that is what I want to make sure the focus doesn't get taken away from, and that we put the appropriate emphasis on those, which to me are the primary skills we're looking for in those company officers.
Okay, now I 100% agree. Like you, I think education has its place within the fire service, and it definitely has its place within rank. To me, you cannot be, especially because I love how you mentioned for company officers, yes, you expect them to be able to write an email, verbally communicate with the public or to city council, whatever the case may be. But I think it's more important as you get up to like chief officer rank, where you budgets. Grants, like that's where I feel like it, education plays a bigger factor, but I love how you stated that.
Absolutely, absolutely. There are what I loved when I got to Stockton as a young firefighter is I came with a lot of education. I had a graduate degree, but what I loved was there were guys that were here that came out of high school and got hired at 21, and I was 31. Well, actually 31 when I tested. I was actually 33 when I started the academy. And I was learning so much from these firefighters. Like, it didn't matter that I came with a graduate degree. It wasn't about that. It was about everybody had strengths and looking. I was so impressed with the variety of person that we had in the department that you could learn so much from these different people. And like I said, I learned a ton from these young firefighters and some of them senior firefighters that had gotten on the job early, right out of high school. And they didn't have any formal education. Now, is there a place for that? Absolutely. You don't really want your fire chief sitting in a meeting with, probably an AA degree, talking to people that, have master's or bachelor's degrees. Like, it's not that it's not possible. It's just that there are some perceptions out there that we have to, again, to be considered that profession, I think there's a certain boxes that we need to check. So,
Absolutely.
and that's why I'd
Absolutely.
leave it with the chief officer's side.
Okay. All right. Now, when you became captain, where was your assignment?
So I stumbled right into staying at my water rescue house. So I spent almost 9 years there as a firefighter. I will tell you, Chief Neerham was my first captain off of probation. He recruited me to come to the water rescue house. So I worked for him on his crew. And one of the things that he taught me early on was that your people need to have ownership and they need to feel part of the organization. So from a young age, I say young age, a young as a firefighter, young career as a firefighter, they were giving me opportunities in the water rescue program. So I went to water rescue, swift water instructor school. Whatever I wanted to do, they allowed me those opportunities. So I became kind of a quasi subject matter expert kind of in water rescue. I loved it. We were passionate. We had the surface rescue and we had dive rescue at the time. So we would, go out to the east, the west of us here, a lot of car accidents, water, cars in the water type of thing. So I had a great passion for it. As I got a few years into my firefighting career, I kind of started taking over some of the surface rescue stuff. So when I promoted to captain, there was a captain that had been at the station. He was actually my captain at 13s, and he was looking to transition out. He kind of knew that there was a younger person like myself kind of coming in with a lot of energy. And so that's the way our station water rescue program worked, was if you felt like you had kind of taken it to your, the level you felt good and you saw someone kind of behind you ready to take over, a lot of our captains would step out, go to other firehouses. And so the opportunity opened up for me to take over on the A shift there at Station 6. So,
Okay.
yep.
And with that, what was one of your non-negotiables as a company officer at that station for your members?
Non-negotiable. Well, we were going to be good. I mean, we were going to be good at what we did. And so we had to put a lot of emphasis and training into the water rescue side. I feel like at the time we were probably diving maybe once a month on average. I mean, we were, 12 to 15 dives, probably 35 to 40 dives a year between the three crews. So, and we felt like it was one of the most dangerous things that we were doing. Aside, even going into a burning building, we felt putting people underwater, all the entanglements, all the stuff that could happen there by themselves with a backup diver sitting on the surface, we felt like you had to feel competent in your skills. So we spent a lot of time training. We went to the pool. We do blackout dives. We do a lot of stress inoculation type of things, trying to get people to realize, okay, I'm in a stressful situation. How do I get out of it? How do I calm myself down? And quite honestly, as Chief Neerham, as my captain at the time, would tell me, it transitioned perfectly to the fire ground. If you ever got into a situation on the fire ground where you were, entangled or stressed or whatever, finding the way to kind of bring yourself back down to ground zero and figuring out the problem and finding a solution. So my biggest thing was my people were going to feel comfortable when they went subsurface to dive. They were going to feel comfortable and confident in their skills.
Okay. And as far as the fire side of Stockton, I'm sure you have busy companies and they're fortunate where they can get that real world experience with the fires that they go to. But how does Stockton preserve that like this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to pull lines. This is how we're going to act on the fire ground. Just because, like, I'm sure there are so many other people that watch Stockton like I do, and they're like, how can I bring that type of, how can I get that culture into our department?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, a lot of it does come from sets and reps.
Right.
I mean, there just honestly is when you get sets and reps, you can take what you've been doing in training and you can just continually practice it. And I mean, I just like I said, in my career, I left for 6 months and was a deputy chief at another department. And they trained really hard, and they were super professional and always looking to be better and get better. And then you look at the reps, and the reps weren't always there, so they didn't get as many reps to pr practice or perform what they were practicing.
Right.
And it doesn't make them any different. Culture-wise, I think if you have people in your organization, you know, that feel like truly adopt that idea of what our role is as a firefighter to preserve life, property, environment, that we're getting paid to take risks, that we're getting paid to take calculated risks, we're getting paid to put our lives on the line. I think if you have those people in your organization driving your training, driving a lot of things in your organization, you can build that culture, even if you don't necessarily always get the reps to back it up. When you do get those reps, I think that would come out. Those, you know, that behavior or that attitude would come out. But like I said, for us, it's almost easy because we get the reps.
Right.
And so you get to what you were training on, what you were practicing, those hose pulls, those forcible entry techniques, what we were teaching people, boom. I mean, you leave the training ground, and later that night, you're at a fire operating using those skills. So I remember when I was in the academy, we had two instructors, and their entire thing was, we need you, not that you will have the experience that you'll have after 10 or 15 years, but we need you prepared to leave this academy and maybe go to the biggest fire you will have of your career tomorrow. And so that was the mentality that we always trained with. So.
And when it comes to as far as standards, like it's the Stockton standard. And if you don't meet it, I'm sure they will provide you assistance to get there, to get to that level. But at some point, if that individual just not everybody's meant to do this job, I'm sure you guys have parted your ways with individuals.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have. So one of the things I want to look at is I haven't had time to do that just in prioritizing priorities here, but is to look at our hiring process and making sure that we're hiring people that we have a real strong confidence can be successful, so that we don't have to invest time and energy into people, even in the academy. But inevitably, that is going to happen. You're going to have people that you hire that aren't meeting a standard, and again, usually there's no hard feelings on. We try to make sure they got the opportunity. We gave them the appropriate opportunities and training and guidance that they needed. And at the end of the day, if they're not meeting the standard, absolutely, we will dismiss those people. Typically, I'm super proud this academy. We have an academy going on right now, and we brought in 18 recruits, and we have 16 recruits that are just doing great. And so two ended up leaving early in the process in the academy, and the other 16 have just been, you know, kicking butt and doing great things, and they graduate the 4th of December here. So again, my goal would be that we develop our hiring process and our testing process for such a way that we find the right fit and people find the right fit, and then we don't necessarily have that down the road scenario where people aren't meeting the standard. Inevitably, it's going to happen without a doubt. But yeah, we're definitely not to beat a dead horse. I look at it like this: if I'm going to put you out on the line as a firefighter, I cannot feel that you're going to jeopardize your safety, the safety of any crew, or you're going to be a detriment to the community in any way. And so that's the standard with which we're training and evaluating our people.
Love that. Okay. And when did you decide to move on from, I'm assuming you went from company officer to battalion chief?
I did. I actually was company officer there at Station 6 for 3 years, and then I decided to take a little change of course. We had a captain's position available in our fire prevention office. So I actually went into fire prevention for 2 years, and primarily it was a little bit selfish and a little bit for career stuff, but I have 3 boys, and so they were very involved in sports. So the administrative captain spot got me a chance to get weekends off and get nights
Gotcha.
off. So I got to spend some time with my family, see my sons do their sports things. And then, of course, I just wanted to get a learn a different area of the fire service, which was fire prevention. So it was an awesome experience. I spent two and a half years there, and then promoted to battalion chief. I was promoted to battalion chief, and then was in that role for a little while. And then the opportunity came to help run our dispatch center and our EMS division. And that rank is considered, we call that a division chief rank. So
Okay.
then I moved to the division chief rank from there. So.
Okay. And when you became a battalion chief, did you feel like it was totally different? Because I'm assuming you don't have an aide, right? You are in the buggy yourself.
Yes, correct.
Was that how was because I hear it that whenever firefighters and company officers eventually get promoted to battalion chief, they either feel like there's like a separation, a disconnect, because you're by yourself in the car. You're not really a part of the crew, but you are. But let's so I just want to hear your thinking on that.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a transition. I think people have to be prepared for that transition, and quite honestly, that is what, as a fire chief, that is actually what I expect. I expect there to be a separation. Like, you're no longer part of the crew. Like, you're really an arm of the fire chief's office in a way. And so there should be some separation. Our battalion chiefs, obviously, we have 2 battalion chiefs on duty per day. They're each stationed at a firehouse. So, they get that interaction where they eat dinner with the crews. Their offices are there at that fire station, so they interact with the crews. But I also want them to understand that they are now at a different level. There is now a separation, and they may have to, discipline multiple people. They may have to, correct somebody's strategic decision on a fire ground, So they have to carry with them a certain weight and authority that just naturally separates them. But you're right, it does feel kind of lonely sometimes. But we have a really good working relationships amongst our chief officers. And that's one thing that I would really highly recommend, is that as a fire chief, I've tried to continue to foster that, where our battalion chiefs, feel supported by the chief's office, and then they feel the camaraderie amongst themselves. So, like our 2 battalion chiefs on duty, we try to really make sure they have a good working relationship and that they feel supported, and knowing that their structure, their support network is not what it used to be. They don't have the crew to go to. They don't have the stuff, the banter, and all the stuff that maybe they used to have. So
Right.
yeah, it's definitely a transition, but one that I think is kind of essential in a way.
Okay. And fire chief. the coveted title for some that are listening. How did that whole process come about with you potentially putting the hat in, or how did that even work?
Yeah, so like I said, I had kind of I had done different assignments. Every assignment I was in, I just wanted to do the best job I could do. I have certain skill sets I think that work well, and so I guess what I would say is every fire chief is different, and there's a bunch of different styles, and whether it's a leadership style, whether it's a management style, there's a bunch of different styles out there. So be yourself. Don't try to be somebody else. Don't try to be Chief Carr. Be who you are and recognize what strengths you have and really lean into those strengths. And then where you have weaknesses, that's where you build a team that supports your weaknesses. And I'll give you an example. Like I said, I feel like a couple of my strengths are I'm a pretty good problem solver. I'm a strategic thinker. I think outside of the box. And so I use those, and I'm pretty relatable. Like I can relate to the firefighter, I can relate to the city manager. Like I feel like I'm pretty relatable. Those are my strengths. I lean into those strengths. If it's deciding, something operationally because I've been out of it for a little while, I feel like, hey, that's Chief Neerham's wheelhouse. Chief Neerham, I mean, there's not a more operationally sound person in the country that I would rely on to teach my people good, sound operational practices. Do I need to get down and get in the mud and mix that up? No, I don't. So again, finding the right people to help support you in what you're doing. Kind of how I fell into this role was, like I said, I had left to go and take a deputy chief spot at a neighboring department. Our former fire chief here was looking for some other opportunities. This opportunity was coming available here in Stockton. I decided that I would come back here. I came back here as a deputy with the idea that I could put my name in the hat for the fire chief position. They knew me. I had 20 years of experience. Well, not at the time. I had 19 years of experience here. I think my reputation spoke for itself. My background, it spoke for itself. And I felt like, living here in the community, being a part of the Stockton community, I raised my kids here. They've been to the high schools, two in college, one still in high school. I think that everybody felt like it was just a good fit. So I was ecstatic to come back. And like I said, never ever thinking that this is what I would do. But as the opportunity presented itself, I knew it was something that I wanted to be a part of. So.
Okay. Now, with that, just that this question is, it's mainly for me. When you accept the role of fire chief of an organization, is there a period where, like, the chief leaving goes, hey, this is kind of what I was working on? Or is it like, all right, if I'm the former fire chief, I'm signing my paperwork, I'm leaving stuff on the desk, and I'm gone. Like, how does that transition work where you're kind of up to speed on, hey, this is where we're at with city council, things like that? How does that work?
Yeah, and I think it completely varies. I've been watching some of my colleagues who have been getting some chief jobs, and I think it varies sometimes, unfortunately. I was lucky enough to have Chief Edwards still here in the transition, and I want to say for probably a good 2 or 3 month overlap where he really was able to, hey, Chief Carr, this is what I got. This is what we got going on. This is what's coming down the pipe. We had a really big fire. We created a JPA with two other fire departments here locally, and we were getting ready to put the bid in to take over the ambulance transport industry here in the county. So that was just a huge project, And Chief Edwards was able to help. I'd been involved in it a little bit while I was here as the division chief, but he's able to help walk me through it, help lay the foundation for what I would need to succeed. So it was awesome here in the way the transition worked. Some of my colleagues that I see getting chief jobs out there, I see the chief's already gone and, has been retired or resigned or whatever happened. And I feel for those individuals. I'm always hopeful that everybody in each department across the country wants the best for their department. So if I had a new fire chief coming in and I was a deputy or division chief, I would do whatever I could to help support them, knowing they're coming in and they've got to do some catch up and hit the ground running. So it's going to vary wherever you go. But here, I definitely had that foundation coming from Chief Edwards and helping me kind of, learn what was on the horizon and the things that were in the pipeline. So.
Okay. And your first day, you walk into the office, it's the fire chief's office. Like, I just want to, because I don't want to say I'm selling myself short, but I have zero aspirations of getting to that level. But what does that feel like when you walk in? Like, you get a chance to sit in your office and you're just looking around and knowing that your title is fire chief of such and such fire department.
Well, that's it is a little bit, it I guess imposter syndrome.
Okay, interesting.
So like, wait a minute. I will tell you, Danny, there are still times, even I mean, it's officially been, I think, 3 months now, but there are times I still put the uniform on and I'm like, fire chief, like. Or I go to a function and people are like, this is the fire chief, this is Chief Carr. And it's like they give me this respect and this, and I'm just like, whoa, like, wait a minute. Like I'm Brian Carr. Like that's who I am. Like I understand you think there's some like I'm just Brian, like I'm just a dude. I'm just Brian Carr. So sometimes it's really weird for me. I need to do the position, serve the position the right way. And so I feel like sometimes, I want to just be Brian Carr, but no, I'm actually Chief Carr, and I have to remember that. And like I said, there are times when I'm like, I can't believe I'm wearing this uniform with this badge. I'm super humbled, super honored. But again, I try to keep grounded to realize like I'm just Brian Carr. I have a certain set of strengths. That's what I'm leaning into. That's where I think I can help the department. I have a bunch of other people between deputies, division chiefs, battalion chiefs, captains, all the way down to firefighters who all have a part in making this organization great. And I'm just going to try to do the little part I can and support them to continue to do great things. So.
Okay. Earlier, before we started this, you sent me an email you sent out to your organization where you talk about your intent for the organization, your key tasks, your vision, your values, philosophies, expectations of yourself, expectations of personnel, and of course, the vision, mission, values. Reading it, and I won't read it all because it's a couple pages, but reading it just shows, I wish, my personal opinion, I wish we had more chiefs that view their position and the power that they hold the way you do. And I'm not saying you've even said it. I'm not saying that others need to be like Chief Brian Carr, but I'm sure talking to the individuals I have, we know many chiefs who, once they take that position, it's all right, this is how we're going to do business. There's no communication, there's no vision. If whether your department has three or four shifts or platoons, everybody does something totally different. The fire department's not the same. So why was it important for you to send that email and have it worded the way you did?
Two experiences, I guess I would say. One, I'll give a shout out to. I'm currently in the International Association of Fire Chiefs, runs a executive leadership program. It's called the Fire Service Executive Development Institute. They have a cohort every year. I'm in cohort number 13 this year. Currently, we have four opportunities to get together. A week long each opportunity with prospective fire chiefs and recently promoted fire chiefs. And that group and those people and the IAFC and Chief Mykos, retired Chief Mykos, Mary Beth, they really instilled in me the need to have a clear vision, to have clear expectations for my people and to be able to articulate it. Like I had, Danny, I had a lot of this stuff in my thoughts. It was kind of how I led people naturally, but to literally be able to put it down on paper so that my people could see it and I could also, they could hold me accountable to it. And that's what I've told most of my crews as I go around and talk about this document, is this isn't so much for you, meaning the crews, which it is, but it's also for Chief Carr to be able to hold myself accountable when I read this document every week and go back and say, how do I want to lead this organization? And putting it down on paper really, really makes you think about it. Like it's not just thinking in your brain, like, okay, yeah, that's a great idea. Like when you put it down on paper, it's like, okay. That really makes sense, or that really doesn't make sense. So I felt like putting it down on paper, my cohort through IAFC, like I said, really emphasized, make sure you have something like this put down on paper for yourself and for your people. And it's a way for them to hold me accountable and me to hold myself accountable. And I always tell them, the part for them is at the very back where it says Fire Chief's expectations of Stockton fire personnel. And I tell them, those are my expectations of you. If you stay within those expectations, within those boundaries, you have my 110% support. I will, run up the hill for you every single time. If you get outside of those boundaries or outside of those expectations, you start to eliminate my ability to help in a situation. So if you got yourself in something that falls outside of those boundaries, you're starting to get out on your own where I can't support you as a member of the department. But again, that's kind of going to the extreme. The second thing that came about with this document was I read a book and it was called Team of Teams by one of our military leaders back in 2004. And they were talking about the special forces and how we had the best trained people, the best equipment, and we were losing. And the Taliban was moving and constantly changing and adapting to the environment. And the U.S. Armed Forces weren't doing that. So he decided that he was going to basically eliminate the silos, give everybody the information. So CIA analyst, FBI analyst, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, everybody was on a Teams meeting. Everybody got the information. And then everybody was given that information. And when they got the information, then they were empowered to make decisions at their level. So the decision didn't have to run back up the chain and then back down the chain, because by the time that happened in the prior history, the Taliban would be gone, would change, adapt, whatever. So that book really helped me articulate, I want to eliminate silos. I want my people to have as much information as they can have. And then they need to feel empowered to make decisions at their level. It's kind of a shift for our organization because I think there was a lot of running things up the chain. Hey, can we do this? Can we do that? And I'm like, man, I want to be thinking about, future firehouses. I want to think about future staffing models. You guys, I'm giving you the information you need and empowering you to make decisions. So that was kind of the basis of that document when I talk about leaders' intent and how I wanted them to be able to feel empowered to make decisions.
Which, like I said, to me, if anybody else got the chance to read it, you would obviously tell like it's not about you. You obviously care, and I'm not saying there aren't other fire chiefs out there that feel the same way. That's their mindset, but you're here to serve your people by trying to give them every potential avenue to make themselves better, but not only themselves, the organization, of course, the community, because without the community, we don't have a job. We are funded by the taxpayers. You know, they essentially pay our salary and they expect a level of service. So I love that you sent that. So my next question for you is, as fire chief now, in your opinion, what does the term aggressiveness mean to you?
So I kind of hit on it a little while back in our interview. I was aggressive and I was trying to think of the best way to define it, but aggressive to me is you make every assumption in favor of saving life, property, and the environment. I want our people to always assume if we're going to a structure fire until it's confirmed otherwise, I want us to always believe there's a possibility of a life that needs to be saved. If we confirm primary search confirms nobody, no life to be saved, well, our next step is property. How are we aggressive in our trying to mitigate the emergency relative to property? Can we confine it to that room of origin? Can we confine it to that building of origin? And again, the risks benefit analysis is always happening, and we're always going to be more conservative in our approach, but it doesn't mean that we don't aggressively try to protect property. And the way I look at it is the community does not hire us and pay us to stand around and watch destruction continue to proceed.
Right.
They've hired us. They expect us to actually intervene in the middle of the emergency, somewhere, wherever that is, and stop the bad chain of events that is happening. And that's what we teach our people is that we are there to intervene and stop the bad chain of events that are happening to the best of our ability with taking reasonable, calculated risks to stop that emergency. And one of the narratives that I'm trying to shift is that we used to always identify how much property damage happened. Oh, there was $30,000 in property damage. What I'm trying to get across to the community is how much value, how much property value, how much life value was saved
Okay.
because the fire department intervened in the emergency. And people talk about a fire department being an insurance company. And I say, no, we're absolutely not an insurance company. An insurance company, an insurance policy comes in after the damage and the destruction has occurred and says, okay, we'll help rebuild whatever. No, we come in the middle of an emergency and it's our job to mitigate the emergency, to stop it, to break the chain of events that's happening. If that's related to saving life, property, or environment, that's what we're going to do.
And I'm sure you've seen a shift, maybe not at Stockton because that's the way Stockton is, that's the way their mindset has always been as an organization. But back a couple of years ago, it was like we were putting our safety in front of the community where, you know, they don't have the SCBA, they don't have the gear. A good number of organizations, when they were pulling up, were looking at the structure and going, if somebody's in there, they're probably gone. We're going to go defensive. So now there's a shift between conferences and micro conferences, mini conferences, cadres that are teaching, listen, search. We are going to search. All the information we're getting from Chief Brian Brush, Lieutenant Basil from Florida, like all the percentages of where people are found, victims are found. How has Stockton always kept that from happening? From like, you know, where it's like, hey, listen, the firefighters are more important than the citizens.
I think again, it goes back to that initial day one. Like day one, the culture has always been that we've been hired to help the community. Like going back to that document, the very first sentence that I put in there is the Stockton Fire Department is about service to others 100% of the time. That's what we are hired to do, is to serve other people, serve the community. We know that that comes with risks. Aside from service to the community, as I already said, the 1B is the health and wellness of my employees. Do I ever want to be a chief that has to give a line of duty death notification? Absolutely never. That is my worst nightmare. That is what does and would keep me up at night. Those things. But again, there are certain things that are just, we can't plan for everything. We can't
Correct.
script everything out of an emergency scenario. That's why, honestly, I think, Danny, what Stockton does a good job of is training our people not to be robots. So, like, we are robots in the sense of, like, hey, first in engine's gonna, pull a line. Second in engine's gonna, if water is not established, we're gonna get a water supply. So we have a very good script, but we also want to train our firefighters not to be robots. That you have to be thinking, things are gonna change. There's gonna be conditions on the fire ground that are gonna change. You have to be aware of those. You have to see those. You have to recognize those. And some of that just comes with experience. And that's why, like I said, we don't want to lose our people. We want to keep our institutional knowledge, and people grow with that knowledge, and they grow with district familiarization and the challenges that each district has. So that's kind of the culture that we just, it gets kind of spread throughout the organization. And I think that's why it's always been that way. And then you see these examples of people being pulled out of a back bedroom. Like, you see it, and you, like, hey, there was heavy fire at the front. Heavy fire, hard to get through the front door. But a crew went around the back and vented search and found that victim in the back bedroom. And it can happen. Those people can survive those certain areas within the structure. So again, we instill that from day one, that we're here to protect the community and help them in their time of need. And with that, there comes a certain amount of risk. It's inevitable. So,
And I feel like too, you guys also let, like, we in this profession, we can do everything right and something happens. Like, it's to me, it's like the law of averages. It's life. Like, nobody, and you stated it, and I've talked to other fire chiefs before in the past on interviews where they're like, yeah, line of duty death, no fire chief wants to be a part of. But we can't be foolish to think it could never happen.
correct.
And the best way to do that is allow your members the freedom, the knowledge, the training, like, hey, this is your job, this is what you're gonna do. And you said it best, you're not training robots. You're allowing your firefighters to think freely, because for me, I think the worst thing you could do is have a company officer that's afraid to make a judgment call because of fear of retaliation or fear of, they're not gonna have my back. And when you start second guessing yourself in what we do, I think that's the recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. No, you're spot on. We had a recent line of duty death 3 years ago, the end of January 2022. And it was one of those scenarios you're kind of talking about where, like, we kind of feel like we did most everything right. Like, there wasn't a lot we necessarily would go back and change about stuff leading up to the incident. And I mean, it's devastating. It's those things last and stay with the department forever. Captain Fortuna, all of us know that that's what we signed up for, and it's part of the job. I was doing an interview a couple weeks ago, and they were talking about technology and how it's changed the fire service. And I said, you know, it has changed the fire service and it will continue to change the fire service. But at the end of the day, you're going to need people on hose lines to go in buildings and put water on fire. Like, you know, you can create, you know, and then like 3 days later, I saw some robot walking around shooting water out of the end of its, you know, and I'm like, you know, at the end of the day, the fundamental job of a firefighter, I don't think will ever change, but we will use technology to help us. And, you know, if it can make us safer, we will do that. And if I was a fire chief and I wasn't evaluating those concepts, then I would be negligent in my duties. But like I said, there's a certain inherent risk. And we just try to make that clear. And, you know, like I said, without getting too emotional about it, like I was talking to my crews and I'm like, you guys are like my family. Like you are literally like you that are 20 years old are like my sons, and you that are like 45 and 50 are like my brothers. And that's the way I look at it as a fire chief. And so we are going to do everything we can to see everyone go home at the end of the shift, but we're also going to make sure we carry out our mission and what the community expects us to do. So.
Okay. As far as communication, and I mean communication amongst your administration, it's been my opinion through talking and discussions and actually seeing it that successful departments have communication bottom to the top, top down, especially the top and whoever they have within their inner circle to make the progression of their department go forward. How important is communication where the individuals, the boots on the ground, hear from the fire chief every once in a while? And I'm not talking personnel issue because, of course, everybody knows it's a personnel issue. You should know, like, it's not your business. But as far as everything else, to make that engine running, the oil's flowing smoothly through that engine, how important is communication?
I mean, I think it's number one, to be honest with you. I think our people, if we don't give them information, they're gonna fill in the voids with something else, right? So I just got done doing my rounds. I tried to hit every firehouse on every station or on
Okay.
every shift. It took me like 2 months at least. I set aside 3 hours on a Thursday afternoon and I'm going to go to that firehouse. I'm going to pick a firehouse. I'm just going to go over there and sit down. And the best thing I can do is have a blank piece of paper. You know, I'm not showing up with my agenda. I'm not showing up with, you know, what I want to. There are some things that I definitely want to communicate to the staff, but I need to be a listener. And some of the best leaders are the people that can listen and take input. And so I'm that way all the way up from my deputy chiefs all the way down to my firefighters. And we just had our quarterly officers conference where we had 3 days each shift. Company officers came in and we talked. We usually try to do like a little educational component, and this one we did on safe driving of our apparatus. We had the California Highway Patrol come in and talk to us about safe driving and all the things that they look at. We kind of consider them our code three driving experts because they get so much training. So they came in, and then we had a union presentation. We had the deputy ops presentation, and I sat through all three of them, just hung out there. And then I had a few comments to add. And then I said, hey, does anyone have any questions for me? There's not a single question that I won't answer. And if I can't answer it, I'll just tell you I can't answer it because we're in the middle of planning. It's too early in whatever stage or whatever. So communication, like I said, to me is probably number one on a fire chief's to do must do list. You have to communicate with your people. I learned a couple years ago when I was running our EMS and our dispatch division, I would bring in both divisions. I had people from each division. We would do one staff meeting with both divisions. And you would be amazed at like what EMS would say to me, "Oh my word, I didn't know dispatch was doing this, and I can see how this can help EMS." And then dispatch would say, "Hey, I didn't know EMS was looking to do this. You know how we can help in dispatch? It was phenomenal. It was at that moment in time, I learned I cannot predict what somebody's going to pick up from a conversation. So I try to have as many people in the room as I can.
With you going around firehouses, are you comfortable enough to sometimes hear things that I don't want to say it's a hard pill to swallow, but it's like I didn't realize this was going on without feeling offended because it comes from somebody that with less rank than you? Because I feel like when if fire chiefs do that, they don't get the full picture because firefighters or company officers are going to feel like they have to hold back a little. And I'm not saying you have to you belittle the chief or you come in swearing, but you have to have tough cop like chief, did you know this was going on? Like being able to have that relationship.
So, Danny, this is a between me and my people from deputy chiefs down to firefighter. This is an ongoing process. So, overnight, it's not going to happen. That free flowing sharing of information, it's not going to happen overnight. But I think because people know my history and they know what type of person I am, I think they trust me. So trust like that, along with communication, is another must have for your fire chief. So I tell people like I need to know the bad stuff. I need to know what's not working, because if I don't know, you can't assume that I know it. And so if I don't know it, then I can't fix it. I can't change it. And secondly, I would say, even if it's bad, I would much rather hear it now from you guys than have something catastrophic or something terrible happen because of this bad stuff going on or stuff we needed to fix, and I didn't know about it, and no one told me about it. I would rather take the tough information now, process it, talk to our staff, figure out, hey, this was brought, this is going on. What do we need to do, and find a way, as opposed to just bury my head in the sand and say, hey, everything's great here. We got no problems. No, I need to hear the problems. I absolutely, but it's not going to happen overnight. I think it's a process where the staff, the crews, they start to learn me, trust me, know that I got their back, and then that information will flow as well.
Okay. My next question is a little bit lighter. It's a softball type question, but I'm sure people want to know. Stockton does 48.96, correct?
Correct.
With you knowing the probability that that any of your companies are either going to go to a fire or multiple fires in a shift, how do you balance it where let's just say you visit a firehouse. You have to stop in, I don't know, to go to the bathroom or something. You stop in a firehouse. It's 2:30 in the afternoon, and the guys are maybe sitting in the recliners if you have recliners. Like, how do you remember, like, okay, I want my guys and gals prepared for whatever, but I also understand like they need a little downtime. Like, we know where it's not like we have to find something to do for busy work.
Yeah. Great question, Danny. It's funny because I will walk into firehouses and I will see somebody in the recliner. Maybe it's 2:30 in the afternoon. And I think this is where the trust comes in, is I try to lead by example. So I when it's time to work, I mean, I'm gonna work. I'm gonna grind. I'm gonna there was a chief crush work, he used to say. I crush work. Like, I'm gonna just grind. And that's what I feel like I do. And so because I do that, I think people realize, well, and that's how our culture is in Stockton, is you're gonna work. And when it's time to work, you need to work. So when I walk into a firehouse and there's somebody in a recliner, maybe at 2:30 in the afternoon, I literally go to that place of like, they were probably up all night. They were probably, up at 7:30 this morning after not sleeping very much, and had a school presentation at 9 and some drills at 10:30 with a probie. And so yeah, they had a late lunch or they had a longer lunch. Like, You have to give your people the benefit of the doubt. You have to trust your people that you've built a culture, your department's built a culture, that when it's time to work and it's time to get things done, you're going to get things done. So, I don't think, and I think I've got enough credibility that when I walk in the firehouse, and if they happen to be on that recliner, they're not actually jumping up either. And I mean, they are truly, I mean, they understand that I understand what the shift is like and the things that come with it. And to be quite honest, if you were up all night, I worked Engine 9 where we would run close to 7,000 calls a year. And if we were up five times after midnight, I would expect my guys to grab a nap. Like, because it wouldn't be prudent for them not to. And then, go into our second evening where we might run another five calls after midnight. So, yeah, it's just that give and take. It's that trust. It's that accountability. Everyone being accountable for themselves, where, hey, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And until I have reason not to trust, then we'll go down that route. So,
Okay. 7,000 calls.
67, 6,800 at Engine 9.
And so I'm assuming though, all right, when it comes to like fire prevention, October is usually that time of month where fire departments are visiting schools, churches, daycares, all that good stuff. I'm assuming you guys also keep in mind with certain companies that run that many calls, you don't overwhelm them or overflood them with things, right? You're considerate of their time is the best way I can say that.
Absolutely, Danny. A couple years ago, we used to do all of our multifamily residential inspections. So anything that had three units, like a triplex or greater, were required by state law to inspect. Those were all being done by our crews out on the line. And a couple years ago, we realized as our department was, running 50,000 calls annually with 13 fire stations, we realized we're over taxing our people to where it's taking away from even some of the training. Had a lot of new recruits coming in. We wanted our crews to spend more time on training and getting out, doing the training with our people. It's always great, don't get me wrong, it's always great to do these inspections because you get to see different buildings and you can use it that way. But then some of it just takes time. I mean, just going and making sure somebody's home and filling out the paperwork. So we gave those assignments back to our fire prevention bureau. And so they handle all those inspections now for that exact reason, to give our people, the rest that they need, to give them the opportunity to get out and do the training they need. And then just knowing that, I have 13 fire engines. And I'd say nine of them at least run over 3,000 calls a year. And I know 3,000 calls in a year is kind of considered fairly busy on a national standard. So, like I said, we've got engines running 6,000 calls, two or three engines running over 5,000 calls. So, just gating back some of that other responsibility for sure.
Love it. Love that. Okay. You've already we've kind of hit on the wellness, how you truly feel like not only are you there for your members when it comes to job performance, but you're also there for them health-wise, mentally, letting them reset where, they're not getting burned out and things like that. So I won't go down that avenue. But my last question for you, I always like to ask the guests, and I know you just got into this position, but where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
I would just rephrase the question in the sense of where would I like to see the department?
Okay.
Because I really don't care about myself, quite honestly. Like, no, I mean seriously, quite honestly, like I probably have another 8 to 10 years, just because of our retirement system. I started late in the process. I was 33 when I got hired, so I'd like to get close to 30 years in the service. I feel like I could be 62, 63, and still sitting behind a desk and still doing the job I'm doing. What's really going to be the catalyst for me is where we are as a department. And I keep telling all of our younger folks, like, that day is going to come sooner than later, where I'm gone, Chief Neerham, Chief Patton, Chief Klein, all my deputies, my division chiefs, where all of us that have the title, and as leaders, where we're going to be gone. And we want to start turning the ship right now in the direction they want it to be in 10 years. Where do they want to be in 10 years? What do they want? Where do they want the department to be? Because we're going to start turning it now so that in 10 years, it's where they want to be when they take over officially as the leaders of the department. And that's what I care more about, is what the condition of the department is like when I leave. We always say it was ingrained from us in day one, whether it was housework, yard work, the rig, that you always leave it better than you found it. That's what I want to do when I leave the Stockton Fire Department, is make sure that the department is better than I found it. And it was already in pretty good darn shape when I took over as chief. So I'm just trying to do whatever I can, whether it's, like I said, some of the strategic planning, making sure we have fire stations on the horizon, making sure we have staffing models that are going to work for our community. Just some of those big picture things. We're starting to run, like I said, next year we'll be overseeing the ambulance transport industry here in the San Joaquin County. So a lot of great, a lot of exciting things on the horizon. So I don't see myself leaving anytime soon, but when it is time to hang it up, as long as I feel like we're in a better position than when I took over, I will be satisfied.
Okay. And you have three sons, three boys, correct?
Three boys, yep.
Have any of them expressed interest in going the fire service route?
Yes and no. Very
Okay.
interesting. The two older ones are in college. They have majors, and they listen, they watch all the videos. I've seen a little more interest recently in the last like year to 2 years, where they're like, oh yeah, firefighting. Yeah, that's they were athletes, they played sports,
Okay.
so they love the team environment. They know what it is to have that camaraderie, that adrenaline. So I wouldn't be shocked if all three ended up in the fire service, but then I wouldn't be shocked if none of them ended up in the fire service. Like, I have been so like, this is my career, this is what I do. You guys figure out what is going to make you happy. Because, like I said, 20 years ago, my wife was the biggest supporter of me doing what was going to make me happy. And that's when I made that career transition. And so I want my kids to do whatever's going to make them happy. And however they're going to have a fulfilled life and feel, like they're providing value, I wouldn't be shocked if they all did it. I wouldn't be shocked if one did or none of them did. And they, but they're all, the best thing I can say is that they're all great human beings and they care about people, and that's all I can ask for. So.
Okay. And I'll probably get chastised if I don't ask. This is like a shameless plug. When is the next time Stockton's hiring? How can individuals keep an eye out for upcoming positions, upcoming, ways to get into the fire service with Stockton?
Absolutely. So we are trying to, the union, the local, has done a great job with our social media
Absolutely. Yes,
and
sir.
the YouTube channels. So as the new fire chief, I'm trying to do a better job with the department, putting out information about how we're out in the community and what we're doing. So we have a Facebook page, Stockton Fire Department Facebook page, that will eventually tie in, and we'll have an Instagram and Twitter and all the other stuff. So following us on social media. I believe there's still links on the Stockton Gov website where you can sign up for interest cards, and you can get an interest card when we're actually sending out applications. I will tell you, we have been doing probably, well, we have been doing two academies a year, but that will probably slow down to probably one academy a year. We have ALS in our fire department, paramedics on every fire engine and fire truck. And we want to continue to provide ALS service to the community. So I'm really looking for paramedics. So if you're, a young person looking to get into the fire service, have your EMT, going the route of getting your paramedic license will definitely make you a very attractive candidate, excuse me, for Stockton and for most of the fire service here in California. And anybody can reach out to us. We'll answer questions. We'll do ride-alongs, as many as we can. We're trying to be as accommodating as we can. We'll let people come down and visit, do a few hours down at our training academy when we have an academy going on. People can watch, kind of get a view of what we're doing with our train with our recruits. So yeah, we're always interested. We use FCTC right now as the hiring entity, so you have to be on the FCTC list, take their test, have your EMT certificate, and that's about all that we require right now. And then we will screen you, start putting you through interviews and all that. But to kind of get a picture of when our application period is open, following our social media pages, and then getting registered on the Stockton, City of Stockton website.
Okay. All right. Chief, man, this has been like Christmas in October for me.
Oh, please.
I know you're humble, but you have like no idea. I'm a fire buff nerd. Like there are certain departments I like follow religiously. Stockton is one of them. I have to thank Chief Ken Johnson
Yep.
with
Yep.
Lodi
Yep.
for putting me in contact with Chief Neerum, and Chief Neerum putting me in contact with you. I always like to give credit where it's due. Thank you,
Yes.
gentlemen. Chief, thank you for coming on, spending time out of your day, talking some shop, letting others know how Stockton does things, why they do things the way they do, and your vision, mission, and values with the department as a new fire chief. I just want to say continue to do great things. Whoever your social media guy is, I love you. You're like awesome with how you do your videos. And sir, that's all I got. I appreciate you.
I'll give him a shout out. That's Kevin Taylor, one
Kevin
of our
Taylor.
fire captains.
Awesome.
Thank you, Danny. It's been a complete privilege to be on here. And again, if anyone ever needs anything, they can reach out to me. I'm happy to help. And it's been an honor to be on your show. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.